Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has an amazing story. He's a former University of Tulsa basketball player who was most recently seen in a supporting role in the Marvel film Guardians of the Galaxy 2 as the Ravager Hukhtar. But how Blondie Baruti ended up in Hollywood or as a Division I basketball player is not the remarkable part of his story. Baruti was born in the Democratic Republic of the Congo near the border of Rwanda, an area that has seen ongoing violence and civil war since the Rwandan genocide in the early 90s. When he was 10 years old, soldiers invaded his village. He, his sister, and his mother fled with nothing more than the clothes on their back. For the next 16 months, they embarked on a 500-mile trek through the Congolese jungle, up and down the country in order to find sanctuary. Eventually, Blondie settled in the capital of Kinshasa, where in school he discovered two loves, basketball and drama. Baruti's talent in basketball helped him get to the United States, where he received political asylum. He was adopted by a family, and his talent attracted the University of Tulsa, which recruited him to play basketball. But only after one season, he suffered a career-ending injury. So he turned to his second passion, acting, graduated from the University of Tulsa, and immediately went to Hollywood, where, like a lot of young people who head to Hollywood, he found it a rough go, living in his car for a while. But eventually, he found some success, and his story seems made in Hollywood. And then he's authored a book of his life, aptly titled The Incredible True Story of Blondie Baruti, My Unlikely Journey from the Congo to Hollywood. And he joins me today here on Studio Tulsa. Blondie Baruti, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and from Los Angeles, welcome back to Tulsa, I guess, in a way. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, sir.
In your life, you have experienced unimaginable trauma, a number of setbacks in your basketball career, at one point taking a huge chance to move to Hollywood, and a number of personal situations that I think would floor a lot of people. And yet what comes through in your story is this remarkable sense of optimism and resilience. What do you attribute that to?
I would say it's because the way I grew up, the way well my mom used to always tell me when I was a little boy, you know, she taught me a lot. She taught me to learn how to love, to learn how to forgive, and to live my life based on what God wanted me to be. And not to give up in my dreams, no matter the obstacles, no matter what comes my way, to keep on going, to keep my head high and keep pounding, keep pushing forward, you know. So that's what I always say about that.
In the very beginning of the book, you tell your family story, and a story that repeated itself for several generations, where the men of your family often left the women and the children. It happened in your grandparents' case and in your mother's case. In both cases, your grandmother and mother seemed to be a real source of inspiration for you.
Yes. I never knew my grandfather, but based on what I heard, he was a very wealthy man, and he kept having kids and wives, and my grandma was okay with it because she loved her husband so much, and she wanted him to be happy, and he wanted to have a big family, you know. And I grew up with a mom, you know, without a father figure. So, you know, just being around both women around my life, it kind of like changed the way I view things in life, you know, the way I want to be in the near future of my life, whenever I get married and start having kids, you know, how I want to be, what I want to show to my future kids. Maybe I want to give to my future kids what I missed my entire life, you know, not having a father figure around, you know, knowing that your father is less than 10 miles away from you and can't even stop by to say, you know, to wish me a happy birthday or wish me Merry Christmas. So those feelings kind of like changed, made me the person I am today.
Yeah. Of course, you describe in your book how the wars in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which, of course, was a spillover from the earlier genocide in Rwanda, affected you as a young person. You said the war in Congo came to your home when you were about 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about a little bit what happened?
Yeah, what happened was there was already war that was happening around the country. I mean, east coast of the country, and for months. And my mom kept telling us, he's not going to reach our part, he's not going to reach our we were living in like a small village, and she was like, "He's not gonna reach out, Paul." And someday she just came in the house. I was hanging up with my sister. She was like, "It was a very, very small house." She's like, "No, we have to go now. Like, you know, we have to go." And I'm trying to pack. She was like, "No, we do not have time to pack. We have to leave." And soon we got out of the house. I saw like a bunch of people, a bunch of families, and you know, they're all running in one direction. It was the left direction, and we just got in the middle of the crowd, and then we started running, and that was the beginning of our journey. And from there, we were in a jungle of the Congo trying to reach the south, and then from the south of Goma, and then we had to reach the north, which it took us about close to 500 miles.
500 miles of walking through wilderness, occasionally coming on villages, and it took us about 16 months.
In a jungle. Just in a jungle, 16 months. And, you know, like in my book, I say, like, the jungle became a part of me, and I became part of the jungle. What I meant by that was, at the beginning, it wasn't normal for me. It was very, very hard, you know, being in the middle of nowhere, no light. You can't even, like, sit fire, you know, like, you know, like, sit around the fire, like, at night, because you don't want the rebel to see the fire. You might come to your group and then kill you guys. You know, and living, you know, laying down on the ground, it was very, very tough. But after I was hungry, and after a while, it became normal to be in the middle of the jungle. It was like our life. You know, like it was okay. You know, I would go like 2 or 3 days without food, and I felt fine. You know, it was okay. I was just playing, laughing, smiling. And it still affects me until these days. I can't stay like 2 days without food. And I'm okay with it. And it became normal, which is, it's not normal to live in jungle, but it became normal at time, you know, when I was 10 years. It became normal for me to be.
Absolutely. After a year, you would think that that is the new normal, that you're, and you're walking literally with only the clothes on your back. Many times you're having to drink out of polluted streams. You know, I assume of the group that you started out with, how many people actually survived?
In the book, I say, because I really don't know the exact number, but if I can guess, I would say a little bit over 100. And then after 16 months in the jungle, it was like less than 40 people made it out. So most of the people died on the road. Like most of them didn't survive. My mom, until today, whenever I talk to her on the phone, she told me, "Blondie, I just don't know how you survived this. I just don't get it, because you were sick. Like you were getting sick over and over and over." And you know, like you see like pictures on the internet about African kids running from war, how skinny they are. Like, you know, you can count how many bones they have, how many ribs they have. That's how I was. Big head, very, very little, very, very skinny, because we don't have food. And I was falling sick over and over, and pulling like your green waters and stuff. And there's no medicine in the middle of the jungle. And she's just like, many kids didn't survive. Many kids died. And sometimes I just sit down there, just a bomb just explodes. Poof, you know, people are like dead. And it was a miracle that we survived that, you know, that we were part of the group that made it out.
Yeah, in fact, your first destination was where you thought would be a sanctuary city. In fact, when you arrived there, it was even worse off than your village. It was practically deserted.
Yes. Kisangani. It was. When we got there, it was whipped out. Like, nobody was, especially in where we were heading. Because Sangani is kind of like a big, little bit of big town. And I was probably trying to head it. It was like nobody. People were running through the rain, you know. I described in the book, my mom was trying to be so strong for us, but I saw pain in her face. And as a young boy, I'm just, in my heart, I was like, what can I do to help? You know, I can't do nothing. You know, to see my mom in this situation. You know.
After 16 months, you finally arrived in Kinshasa, which was your grandparents' home. And there was where you eventually found a safe place to live. Although there were still rebel troops that would sometimes confront you if you were coming home from a basketball court. You would relate one incident where rebels had basically set up a roadblock from where you were coming back from a basketball pickup game. And literally were robbing you. And when you didn't have any money, it was like it was a debate on whether they were going to shoot you or let you go.
Yeah, in the Congo, it's very, very dangerous for young men to walk at night, because the police, there's no like you're here like you. Like in the U.S., you have a computer, you know where the police are going to be at this time of the night. You know, in a Congo, we don't have that. You know, the police can do whatever they want to do, and they kill people every single day, and there's no investigation, nothing. You die, you die. And it was very, very dangerous for younger people to walk at night. But because of my love of basketball, I didn't care. I loved ball. I loved playing basketball so hard that I wanted to take the risk. I wanted to be on the court playing ball and walk home at night. And every time I come home at night, my mom was so angry at me. She's like, "Why you love this game so much? It might get you killed." I said, "No, I'm not gonna get killed, because if I wanted to die, I probably would die like a long time ago. But I'm still here. I'm still alive." And one night I was walking home with my friend. We just saw like a bunch of police just showed up. You know, they started like yelling at us, like, "Give us the money." And my friend was like, "We do not have any money." And they stopped beating the crap out of us. And one was like, "Okay, let's shoot them." You know, and thank God, one was like, it was very, very nice. He's like, "Nah, no, they're young, they don't have any money, let them go." You know, and I was very, very lucky, very, very fortunate, you know, to survive that again, because many people don't. Like almost like every week you wake up in the morning, someone dead on the street. Mm. You know, there's no investigation. His family came and pick up the body. Funeral, and then that's it. Live moves on.
It was in Kinshasa where you discovered your love of basketball. That was the first time you played, probably, what, 12 or 13 maybe?
14.
14. But I should also mention, while you're in Kinshasa, you also found another love, which would later play a role in your life, and that was drama.
Acting. Well, there was a girl. The reason why I wanted to act is because there was a beautiful girl that I loved. I still talk to her today. Her name is Peggy. She was so beautiful. And as a young man, I was so scared to tell her. To tell her, like, "Hey, you are beautiful." I was so nervous. So she was acting at my school plays. So I was just like, okay, the best way for me to get close to her is to enroll in my acting school. You know, so I enrolled to my acting plays. And then, thank God, I play her husband in a play. So this is one of my most regrets. I was hoping that I'm going to kiss her in a play. I was, but it never happened. I even went to our teacher. I was like, "Okay, she's my wife. So what, can I not kiss her?" Like, "No, this is not a kissing. You guys are a little boy. You're a little kid. This is not a kissing scene." You know, so I still talk to her today. I send she's married now. She's like three kids. I send her a message on Facebook like, "Hey, thank you very much for allowing me to love acting, because it helped me today." You know, so it was because of her that I learned how to act. But I was too tall, you know, to keep playing soccer with my friend, and I was alone. I was very alone in acting, because none of my friends was acting. All of them were playing soccer. So I went and played soccer, and I was too tall, way too tall to play soccer. My friend was like, "No, you need to play basketball. You're good to play soccer, but you need to use your size for your advantage." So I started learning how to act, and you know how it went in my story. And yes. I think it was just very, very hard, you know, learn, you know, trying to get to fit in, you know, because I looked different. You know, I was... most of the people that were there, they were like, you know, like, they look cool, bring your clothes, bring your shoes, and I didn't have it. My family didn't have it. So I looked different, and they were kind of like pushing me away, you know, they nicknamed me a lot of names, you know, stupid toddler, you know, because I was just tall and then I couldn't play. But I had a friend who was a DMX, we call him the DMX. He was, I still talk to him today, very, very good friend of mine. He helped me. He motivated me. He was like, "Keep practicing. Keep doing it." And, you know, I would come there around 4 p.m., watch them play until 7, and then I would start practicing by myself for like 2 hours, and then walk home in the middle of the night. And I would get home, and I would get my butt beat up on my mom, because I was...
Taking a chance, yes.
Yeah. So that's how I love basketball. And the thing is, like, I love this so much that I used to wake up in the morning at 6 a.m., walk 4 or 5 miles to the school. After school, get out around 12:30, walk to my to my club practice, and then from there, which was like 4 more miles, and then from there, after practice, walk home in 110 degrees, and walk to my pickup game with my friend around 5 p.m., and play pickup, and then walk home 3 or 4 miles. So I used to walk about close to 15 miles a day without even knowing it. And I figured this out because when I first moved, when I learned about GPS, because I didn't know what GPS was. And I started looking, I was like, wait a minute, here to there, that's 1 mile. That's 2 miles. So wait a minute, so in Congo, when I did the math, I was like, wait a minute, I used to walk about 15 miles a day, and I didn't even know it. So that's how I learned about play basketball. And then I used to tell my friend, listen, I know it's hard here with playing basketball with almost no shoes on, but someday I'm going to go to the U.S. I'm going to make my dream come true. I'm going to go to the U.S. I'm going to play basketball in college, and I'm going to make great things happen. And they were laughing at me because they thought I was crazy. They thought I was nuts because it doesn't happen. The last player that got a scholarship to leave the Congo to come to the U.S.
Yes.
was Dikembe Mutombo. So it doesn't happen. And for me to dream like that, to think like that, they were like, you are nuts. And they're like, look at this player. He's taller, bigger than you. He never got a chance. What makes you different? And I was like, well, I'm different because I have Christ with me. I have Jesus with me. Mm. And he saved me from the jungle of Congo. It's because, it's going to happen for me. And it did happen. My mom, my family didn't spend a dime for me to come to the U.S.
My guest today is Blondie Baruti, an actor and former University of Tulsa basketball player, a graduate of the university, and he is now the author of his life story, The Incredible True Story of Blondie Baruti, My Unlikely Journey from the Congo to Hollywood. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you did come to the United States, and in telling that part of the story, while it was a great thing for you, you were also writing about one of the dark undercurrents within college basketball and organized basketball, AAU and other academies, where, you have a lot of unscrupulous people, coaches, people. You talk about your cousin who helped bring you to America, but he was bringing you there to basically make money off of you. And of course, there are a lot of people like that. And you kind of describe all the legal rigmaroles that you went through, where you were supposed to go to one school, your visa was written to one school, you ended up going to another because a better deal was made. And that existence here in the United States was pretty precarious for a few years. And you really write about this sort of underside where talented young people from around the country who don't have the means to come to the United States are sort of in some ways often exploited. But you were very lucky. You had a family that really did carry for you, the Blitzes, Terry and Lori Blitz.
Yes.
Have you had a chance to really reflect on that part of your life where you were sort of almost treated like a commodity? I think you wrote at one point you felt like your cousin was treating you like a commodity.
Yes. My cousin used me for his own benefit, and when I found out about everything that happened behind the table before I moved to the U.S., I was very, very angry at him because if you read in the book, after I got a visa, I only had like a few weeks to leave the Congo. And my mom was crying almost every single day because we didn't have a plane ticket to bring me to the U.S. It was very, very hard for my mom and for me to watch her crying. Her son got a visa to go to the U.S., but he can't go because he don't have a ticket. And to find out that it was because my cousin, when we could get a ticket to go to the academy, but my cousin blew them away and went to Arizona trying to make a better deal, and that period of time was very, very hard. And I went very, very hard for my mom. And when I found out about it, I was very, very angry at him. But in overall, I really believe, it's all God's plan in my life, because if I ended up going to the Golden Academy, I probably wouldn't be able to write this book, So mm-hmm. I feel like it was all God's plan. God used my cousin to bring me to Arizona, And from there, a lot of things happened in Arizona. It's all to me, I see it as God was building something in my life, to take me somewhere, building a journey so I can to write this book, to talk about this book, to inspire other people. You know, so that's how I see all this journey happening in my life.
Well, of course, when you were at Mesa, in fact, you had to go to Golding for a short time, and then you ended up in Mississippi for a while, and then finally back to Mesa High School, which was also the alma mater of another University of Tulsa basketball player, Dante Metter. People might remember that name along with yours. And, of course, you both ended up coming to the University of Tulsa. But then you have another horrible setback. You're playing just a couple of years, and you're about ready to blossom as a player. And then you have an injury that basically ends your career.
Yeah, it was one of the darkest moments in my life because, listen, like, I grew up in the Congo. I walk about 500 miles in the jungle of the Congo, okay? I played basketball on the ground in 110 degrees, no shoes on, over and over and over and over for days and nights, for hours. And nothing like this ever happened to me. So why just now when moved to the U.S., I'm playing in one of the most beautiful stadiums in the world. And right after my freshman year, 3 days after, you know, I hurt my ankle, and that was it. And that is just, you know, I just could not believe it. I'm just like, why just now? Like, why did I survive all of that to come here and to get hurt? You know what I'm saying? So it was very, very, I collapsed, you know, the doctor's office when he told me, like, you gotta let it go. It's not gonna get healed. It was just like so much pain. Plus, I got hurt in the last play of the pickup. Jordan Clarkson, my friend, who now played for the Cleveland, he asked me for the ball. He said, give me the ball. I said, no, I'm taking it. And I took it to the basket, and then I stepped my friend's foot, and that was it. So it was just, it was so hard. I cried over and over. I was just like, why now? Why now? You know, but to look back today, I would say it was God's plan because I feel like if I kept playing basketball, maybe make it to the NBA, I probably wouldn't be able to inspire people the way I'm doing it today by writing this book, by telling my story.
Yeah.
Probably making all that kind of money in the NBA, you know, I probably would care less about writing a book.
Well, once you couldn't play basketball, you turned back to acting, and after you finished at TU, you said, okay, I'm going to go to Hollywood, which is, of course, that is a brave decision for any actor, and literally you were on the verge of being homeless when you found a pilot that was supposed to be can't miss. It was basically you playing yourself in a way. You were playing a African player who can't speak English, and so he has a translator who doesn't speak basketball, and it was a sure can't-miss hit, but it wasn't picked up, and again, you were on the verge until you landed the role in Guardians of the Galaxy, which was an amazing experience.
Yeah, it was like my book, I talk more about learn how not to give up in life. You know, like I always, you know, always pray and always trying to find another way. You know, I got hurt, and I was like, okay, so what can I do now? Then I thought, like, okay, why not act again? And I was like, okay, this is not good enough. I want to tell my story. Okay, I'm going to start writing my book. And I remember I used to tell Dante and my Jordan, I was like, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a book. One day, I believe a professional writer is going to take my book and going to rewrite it, and it's going to be a best-selling book, and I'm going to inspire people. You were laughing, and you were like, no, you're crazy, man. You can't even speak English really well. How can you write a book? And it's hard to get a book published in the U.S. I was like, okay, it's not as hard than, you know, walking through the jungle of the Congo. I'm going to do it. And I wrote my book. I was taking time between classes because I used to double major business management and theater. So, you know, I would, like, 30 minutes between classes, sit down somewhere, you know, write down my thoughts, you know, how I felt in a certain situation, you know. And then I moved to L.A. 2 days after graduation. I drove, like, 18 hours, and I got here. I got a lot of setback again, you know, sleeping in my car, you know, not having a place to go, you know, delivering food to people's houses, begging for tips. You know, my friend kicked me out of his house. He called me an N-word in front of people, and, you know, he kept all my furniture that I bought for like $7,000-$8,000. But I was like, okay, it's okay, you know, I'm going to survive. I got to keep pushing. And I decided to move back to Oklahoma. And I knew Becky, and she sent me an email. She's like, hey, there's an audition in L.A., you know, for a tall guy, you know, who speak different languages. Do you want to try? I said, sure. And I flew to L.A. and knowing that, believing that I'm going to get there and I'm going to get a job. That's for sure. And I got here. I just killed it. And yeah, and I got a job, and then I met a lot of people for that.
Well, of course, you ended up in the Guardians of the Galaxy 2, where you played one of the Ravagers.
Yeah.
What was that like to see yourself on the screen? Had you ever thought that you would be in a film?
That was probably one of the best feelings of my life. Like, I was next to Sylvester Stallone in the premiere. You know, just watching these people that I always watch on TV since I was a little boy in the club. It was like, I'm next to Rocky. You know, Rocky, like the boxer, Rocky, like, I'm named this
Sylvester
guy.
Stallone,
it was like a mind-blowing. And when I saw myself on TV, I was about to jump and yell, that's me, I made the cut. And Finn was like, no, buddy, you got to be professional, you can't keep it quiet. People wouldn't understand. They might think I'm crazy, but for me to see myself, like, this kid was in the jungle of the Congo. He was in the middle of the Civil War, and today to be in the Marvel Universe, it's mind blowing. I couldn't believe it. You know.
No.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it.
Well, where are you with your acting career to now? I know you've been busy with the book, but are you still hoping for more roles? Or
yeah, for right now, I keep auditioning. It's very, very hard for people like me because I'm 6'7". Yeah. Have an accent. I know when I act, I reduce my accent a little bit, but still have it. And it's not a lot of roles for me, you know, which it's my strength. At the same time, it's my weakness, you know, because I'm different from a lot of people. And I keep auditioning. I keep hoping for or to get a job. But at the same time, I figure like in this Hollywood life, I can't just sit here and then wait. Audition. I feel like I need to find my way in. You know, I gotta make a way for myself. So that's why I wanted to write this book. I'm gonna write this book. It's gonna inspire people, and then we're gonna make movies. And hopefully, I can play myself on it. So right now we, you know, in talk with a big major production company. We are working with them on how we can make movies out of this book. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I wrote three scripts. One, a script based on the book. And then I wrote another one, a boxing movie inspired by my life, and a TV drama inspired by my life. So we have like a different project that we're working on right now, and hopefully they will get.
Well, hopefully we'll see that story down the road. But in the meantime, we can read The Incredible True Story of Blondie Baruti. It's an amazing story of your life. Blondie, I know you have a lot of fans here in Tulsa, so we're so happy for your success, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
Former University of Tulsa basketball player and actor Blondie Baruti speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled The Incredible True Story of Blondie Baruti, My Unlikely Journey from the Congo to Hollywood. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.